Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and now partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. And this week, I'd like to talk about something specific to Iowa from Equal Justice Update, which is a legal aid publication. Foreclosure crisis impacts increasing numbers of Iowa legal aid clients. Early in 2008, Iowa legal aid could see the trends. The advancing economic downturn growing out of the housing crisis was going to have a significant impact on the casework faced by Iowa legal aid staff and volunteer attorneys. While housing issues had always been a mainstay of the organization's practice, foreclosure cases were soon to escalate as the bursting bubble was pushing many Iowans over the edge and making homelessness an impending reality for people who months earlier were well on their way to fulfilling the American dream. Iowa Legal Aid quickly answered the call to join the Iowa Mortgage Help Initiative launched in late February of 2008. The initiative is a partnership among the Iowa Attorney General's Office, Iowa Finance Authority, Iowa Mediation Service, 12 housing counseling agencies throughout Iowa, the Iowa Home Ownership Education Project, and Iowa Legal Aid. Iowa Legal Aid formed the Foreclosure Defense Project in order to most efficiently and effectively meet this growing need in our state. The intent, as with much of Iowa's legal aid's involvement in housing issues, was to keep families in their homes, if possible, in order to maintain a foundation of security for them. At the same time, the community would be spared the costs that are incurred whenever a family finds itself homeless and dependent upon others. The project began to gear up in May of 2008. Foreclosure-related cases rapidly increased and continues to accelerate, with the third quarter of 2009 seeing more than a 200% jump over the third quarter of 2008. The Foreclosure Defense Project and many other Iowa legal aid attorneys spend a portion of their time in this arena. From its inception through August 2009, the project has worked more than 1,500 foreclosure cases, assisting over 4,500 people. In nearly 200 of these cases, the head of the household was a senior citizen. Of the more than 600 cases where foreclosure was imminent, Iowa's legal aid representation has prevented the sale of the home or extended the client's use of the home in more than one half of the cases. Many more cases remain open, with similar results expected. Consider the case of Brenda, a mother who had fallen behind on her mortgage payments. When her lender started foreclosure proceedings, she sought an agreement that would keep her family in the home. The lender was willing to accept three payments that were higher than her typical monthly payment and a fourth balloon payment of $10,000. Brenda knew she could not meet the schedule, but was assured by the lender's agent that if she made the first three payments, the lender would drop the foreclosure and modify the term of the loan. Desperate, she took the agent's verbal assurance and signed the agreement. Brenda incurred additional debt by borrowing to make the first three payments, only to find that no modification would be made and that the foreclosure was proceeding. Iowa Legal Aid intervened and, with the assistance of volunteer attorney help, negotiated a new affordable loan for Brenda and her children. Iowa legal aid attorneys have also seen an alarming number of Iowa seniors facing foreclosure. Many of these seniors had owned their home outright prior to succumbing to pressure to mortgage the home in order to satisfy consumer or health care debts. They then found that the conditions of the new loan placed them in peril of losing their long-time home and facing homelessness during their elder years. Whatever the circumstances that led them to Iowa legal aid, low-income and elderly Iowans facing foreclosure are a rapidly growing segment of Iowa legal aid's caseload and emblematic of the way in which donor generosity translates into hope and justice for Iowans who could find such hope no place else. So that's a tribute to the Iowa Legal Aid Organization. So moving on to the general economy, for all the fury over Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's $700 billion emergency economic relief fund, it seems downright puny when compared to the running total of the government's response to the credit crisis. According to Credit Sites, a research firm in New York and London, the U.S. government has put itself on the hook for some $5 trillion so far in an attempt to arrest a collapse of the financial system. The estimate includes many of the various solutions cooked up by Paulson and his counterpart Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve and Sheila Bair at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp as the crisis continues to plague banks and the broader markets. And from the American Press, just in time, Salvation Army's kettles now credit card ready. There could be less jingle in Salvation Army's Hallmark red kettle this season. The charity is testing kettles that take debit and credit cards. The growth of the so-called plastic kettles comes as fewer shoppers carry cash. Bellringers who stand outside stores during the holiday season say that more and more shoppers are shaking their heads and smiling as they pass by, apologizing for not having spare change or cash to drop in the red kettles. Last year, Salvation Army tested the credit machines in two cities, Dallas and Colorado Springs. This year, the plastic kettles will be tested in more than 120 cities. In Colorado Springs, fundraising last year went up $64,000 from the year before, an 11% increase. About $5,000 of the increase was from donors using credit or debit cards at the kettles. It used to be people would spend their money at the store counters, walk out, and drop their change in the kettles. They don't shop that way anymore, said Major Don Gilger, coordinator of the Salvation Army of El Paso County. We all realize that people are carrying less cash than they did 10 years ago. The kettles that take credit don't look any different, but next to the metal red kettles are wireless card readers that resemble do-it-yourself readers at gas stations. Machines print two receipts, one for the donor and one to drop in the kettle. Salvation Army pays credit processing fees, same as any retailer. But the plastic kettles take some getting used to. In Colorado Springs, volunteer bell ringer Dave Flack wasn't sure what to make of his first day ringing bells next to a credit machine. The 61-year-old keeps a three-ring notebook full of Christmas carols handy to sing to shoppers outside the grocery store where he volunteers, but he needed to borrow a pen from the Salvation Army manager who showed him how to take donations using the machine. Flack said he'd be willing to give it a shot. I've been doing this 5 years, and I hear people say they'd like to help but don't have any cash. I don't know if they'll use this or not, Flack said, but the need is great, so whatever it takes, we'll try it. Shoppers looked at the plastic kettles with interest. No one used it right away, but they liked the idea. This is great. I've never seen that before, said shopper Sarah Trumbly, whose two small children dropped coins in the kettle. A lot of times I'll walk by it and think, I have no cash. That stinks. People are going to be excited to see this. The charity says its red kettles brought in more than $130 million nationwide last year, an increase of 17% from 2007. Salvation Army officials aren't sure how much of the increase came from credit or debit donations. Anecdotal evidence indicates that people who stop to make credit or debit donations make larger gifts, at least a few dollars. Major George Hood, spokesman for Arlington, Virginia-based charity, said that the donation sizes are similar to online donations, which average about $75. Denver area bell ringers getting ready to try the new machines said the plastic kettles could make it safer to volunteer. The charity insists that red kettle thefts are rare, but volunteer bell ringers say robberies happen and that volunteers would be safer standing next to kettles with less cash. It's a lot cleaner process, a lot safer for everyone, said Hardway Boyd, who runs a drug and alcohol treatment program for the Salvation Army and volunteers as a bell ringer. A volunteer he works with was robbed 3 years ago outside a post office, and Boyd called the cashless donations fantastic. The charity says that the old-fashioned kettles aren't going anywhere because shoppers and especially children enjoy dropping coins as they shop for the holidays. Even Salvation Army groups that are using the card machines say they're a small part of the overall fundraising effort. They're still a little cumbersome, Gilger said. They work and we're going to keep using them, but the technology isn't really there yet. Some people are a little leery of it or don't want to stop that long to use the machine. Maybe one day, Salvation Army officials say, the charity will come up with something even faster than dropping a coin. I would love it eventually if we had a little antenna on the kettles and you could walk by and just beam a donation from your phone, Gilger said. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So starting the second segment of the show, I'd like to give a credit. The thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. And right now we've been discussing and using The Two Income Trap as a textbook for the points I've been making in the last month or so. You can also go to the archives at www.kruufm.com and look at Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows that have been produced trying to help you to deal with your debt and to prevent it and have a life that is financially sound. Last week, in the concept of the overconsumption myth, I was talking about bidding wars in suburbs, parents trying to have a situation where their kids are safe and getting the best education possible. The last thing I discussed was those families with middle-class aspirations who earned a little less than average, or those who lived in particularly expensive city areas. Over the last few weeks, we talked about not only the fact that women have joined the workforce in the last generation, but that they are by law entitled to credit, which has changed the whole banking industry. And this led to the fact that in such a situation where families have fallen behind, even though both parents are in the workforce, rather than drop out of the bidding war and resign themselves to sending their kids to weaker schools, many middle-class couples have seized on another way to fund their dream home, and that is take a bigger mortgage. As I mentioned, in 1980, the mortgage lending industry was effectively deregulated. Unfortunately, we're seeing the horrendous results of that decision. But also, as a result, average families could find plenty of banks willing to issue them larger mortgages relative to their incomes. So the bidding war heated up. Families started taking out larger and larger mortgages just to keep up, committing themselves to debt loads that were, frankly, unimaginable just a generation earlier. So what did we see? We saw this extra income now from mom's paycheck and extra mortgage money from the bank, and this caused the usual supply and demand in the market for homes in desirable areas to explode into an all-out bidding war. As millions of families sent a second earner into the workforce, one might expect that they would spend less on housing as a proportion of total income. However, the opposite actually occurred. A growing number of middle-class families now spend more, in fact, much more on housing relative to family income. But as the demand for the limited stock of desirable family housing continued to grow, prices did not reach the natural limit that would have been imposed by the purchasing power of the single income family, confined essentially to a conventional 80% mortgage. Instead, monthly mortgage expenses, now listen to this, took a leap of 69% at a time that other family expenditures like food, clothing, home furnishings remained steady or fell. So parents were caught. It may have been their collective demand for housing in family neighborhoods that drove prices up, but each individual family that wanted one of those houses had no choice but to join in the bidding war. The logic is simple. If one family refuses to pay, some other family snatches up the property. No single family could overcome the effects of millions of other families wanting what it wanted. So, as Professor Warren has indicated, each year, a growing number of stay-at-home mothers
moved into the workforce,
hoping to put their families into solidly middle-class neighborhoods. But the rules had quietly changed. Today's mothers are no longer working to get ahead. Now, they must work just to keep up. Somewhere along the way, they fell into the terrible trap. So that raises the next issue. Can families extract themselves from the two-income housing trap? We make the obvious kind of suggestions. Families should downshift, taking on no more mortgage debt than they could afford. And that seems even more true as we've watched the housing market fall apart in the last 2 years. But the psychology factor is also there. Renting for another 10 years or living in a neighborhood with lousy schools is possibly fine from a financial point of view, but it's not fine from the family orientation, safety, and education point of view. Those goals are essential. They really are the high point of the family situation. Some people have suggested the alternative, possibly a much more liberal approach to dealing with the housing crisis, more government regulation of the housing market, for example, with pricing caps. But frankly, this kind of solution would lead to extraordinarily complex regulations. Any effort to eliminate the fundamental forces of supply and demand with these kinds of regulatory artificial constraints might actually worsen the situation by diminishing the desire to build new homes or improve older ones. There's also the argument for government subsidies, and a lot of this is in the process now, although we've seen a huge amount of resistance to it. But the general thinking is that such programs may be appropriate to help small number of low-income families get a decent place to live. But America simply cannot afford mass subsidies for its middle class to buy housing. And I find this particularly ironic because it certainly is affording huge bailout subsidies to help the upper crust of America, the top 1%. Strange, but that's the way we've gone. But actually, when you look at the subsidy issue with respect to the bidding war, if people have more money, that gives them more ammunition to fight in the bidding war, ultimately driving home prices even higher in those neighborhoods where people want to live due to the educational quality and safety context of that neighborhood. So Professor Warren actually comes up with a very interesting alternative. She says that in order to free families from the trap, it's necessary to go to the heart of the problem, which she defines as public education. Bad schools impose indirect but huge costs on millions of middle-class families. In their desperate rush to save their children from failing schools, families are literally spending themselves into bankruptcy, and I know that, being a bankruptcy attorney. So you go back to the problem and you look at it holistically. The best way to take the pressure off these families is to change the schools. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we've been talking about the bidding war, and frankly, families spending themselves into bankruptcy in order to get a home that is in the best neighborhood and has the best educational system to benefit the kids. So Professor Warren and her daughter have pointed out that the heart of the problem is really public education. When we look at it, the concept of public schools is really deeply American. It's perhaps the most tangible symbol of opportunity for social and economic mobility for all children. It embodies the notion that merit rather than money determines a child's future. But is that a myth? Are we really just kidding ourselves? As parents increasingly believe that the differences among schools will translate into differences in lifetime changes, they are doing everything they can to buy their way into the best public schools. So, schools in middle-class neighborhoods may be labeled public, but parents have paid for tuition by purchasing an expensive home within a carefully selected school district. So stepping back from the whole problem, it's really time to look at it, analyze it in a way that recognizes that the crisis in education is not only a crisis of reading, writing, and arithmetic, it's also a crisis in middle-class family economics. At the very core of the problem is the time-honored rule that where you live dictates where you go to school. So the point that Professor Warren and Amelia suggest is that the ironclad relationship between location, 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 and school, school, school would eliminate the need for parents to pay inflated prices for a home if it is loosened, so that relationship is broken down. And then the inflated price for a home, just because it happens to lie within the boundaries of the location of that so-called better school district, would change. Professor Warren's solution to this problem is what she defines as a well-designed voucher program. A taxpayer-funded voucher that paid the entire cost of educating a child, not just a partial subsidy, would open a range of opportunities to all children. With fully funded vouchers, parents of all income levels could send their children and the accompanying financial support to the schools of their choice. Middle-class parents who used state funds to send their kids to school would be able to live in the neighborhood of their choice or the neighborhood of their pocketbook where they could afford to live. Fully funded vouchers would relieve parents from the terrible choice of leaving their kids in lousy schools or bankrupting themselves to escape those schools. Now, we know that the term voucher has become a dirty word in many educational circles. The reason is fairly straightforward. The current debate over vouchers is framed as a public versus private rift, with vouchers denounced for draining off much needed funds from public schools. The fear is that partial subsidy vouchers provide a boost so that better off parents can opt out of the failing public school system while the other children are left behind. But the public versus private competition misses the central point. The problem is not vouchers, the problem is parental choice. Under current voucher schemes, children who do not use the vouchers are still assigned to public schools based on their zip codes. This means that in the overwhelming majority of cases, a bureaucrat picks the child's school and not a parent. The only way for parents to exercise any choice is to buy a different home, which is exactly how the bidding wars started. Short of buying a new home, parents currently have only one way to escape a failing public school.
send the kids to private school. But there is another alternative, one that would keep much-needed tax dollars inside the public school system while still reaping the advantages offered by a voucher program. Local governments could enact meaningful reform by enabling parents to choose from among all the public schools in a locale with no presumptive assignment based on neighborhood. Under a public school voucher program, parents, not bureaucrats, would have the power to pick schools for their children and to choose which schools would get their children's vouchers. Students would be admitted to a particular public school on the basis of their talents, their interests, or even their lottery numbers. Their zip codes would be irrelevant. Tax dollars would follow the children, not the parents' home addresses, and children would live in a much less expensive house, but have the same educational opportunities as those who live in a house that costs 3, 4, 5 times more. Now, children who required extra resources, such as those with physical or learning disabilities, could be assigned proportionately larger vouchers, which would make it more attractive for schools to take on the more challenging and expensive task of educating those children. It might take some rejiggering to settle on the right amount for public school voucher, but eventually every child would have a valuable funding ticket to be used in any school in the area. To collect those tickets, schools would have to provide the education parents want, and parents would have a meaningful set of choices without the need to buy a new home or pay private school tuition. Ultimately, an all-voucher system would diminish the distinction between public and private schools as parents were able to exert more direct control over their children's schools. Of course, public school vouchers would not entirely eliminate the pressure parents feel to move into better family neighborhoods. Some areas would continue to have higher crime rates or better parks, and many parents might still prefer to live close to their children's schools. But a fundamental revision of school assignment policies would broaden the range of housing choices families would consider. Instead of limiting themselves to homes within 1 or 2 miles of a school, parents could choose a home 5 or even 10 miles away, enough distance to give them several neighborhoods to choose from with a broad range of price alternatives. School change, like any other change, would entail some costs. More children might need to take a bus to school, pushing up school transportation expenses. But on the other hand, many parents might actually shorten their own commutes since they would no longer be forced to live in far-flung suburbs for the sake of their children. The net cost could be positive or negative. We just don't know. What we do know is that an all-voucher system would be a shock to the educational system, but the shakeout might be just what the educational system needs.
In the short run, a large number of parents would likely chase a limited number of spots in a few excellent schools. But over time, the whole concept of the Beverly Hills schools or the Newton schools would die out, replaced in the hierarchy by schools that offer a variety of programs that parents want for their children, regardless of the geographic boundaries. By selecting where to send their children and where to spend their vouchers, parents would take control over schools' tax dollars, making them the de facto owners of those schools. Parents and not administrators would decide on programs, student-teacher ratios, and whether to spend money on art or sports. Parents' competitive energies could be channeled towards signing up early or improving their children's qualifications for a certain school, not bankrupting themselves to buy homes they cannot afford. And we will continue the analysis next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, 4.
Voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.